The Scriptwriter's Revenge. It was a sunny morning in spring 1974. Vernon Coombs, a middle-aged scriptwriter of nondescript appearance, was driving his battered Vauxhall 14 along a busy street in North London. On the seat beside him was a length of hosepipe and a reel of sticky tape. He pulled up at an off-license and went in to buy a bottle of vodka. He thought alcohol would help him carry out the grim plan he had made earlier that day. When he came out with his purchase, his car was gone. He was more upset by the loss of the hosepipe and sticky tape than the car. He walked up the hill and sat down in a churchyard. He was joined by two winos who produced a bottle of British Ruby Red and a tin of export lager. All three shared these, and Vernon contributed his vodka. Then he must have fallen asleep. Vernon told me all this when I ran into him in a pub near Paddington Station. He was on his way to catch a train for Shropshire, where his sister ran an antique shop. He planned to stay a few weeks and get away from it all, but not so far away as he had planned when he bought the bottle of vodka. "How long were you asleep?" I asked him over a glass of real ale. "A few hours, I suppose. I was wakened by a policewoman shaking me by the shoulder. Made my head ache. I said, 'Shut up,' and tried to brush her hand away. She said she was being assaulted and called for assistance over her little radio. I said, 'Look, sweetheart, enough of that sexist talk,' she said. 'And would you believe it? I heard sirens out in the street, and three policemen arrived and bundled me into their car and raced to the police station with the siren going full blast. I might have been public enemy number one. I spent the night in a cell, and next morning I was brought up before a senile magistrate who would like to have been a stand-up comedian. 'It's a very serious offence,' he said, 'being drunk in charge of a tombstone.' I laughed like a maniac at this, and I think that's what got me off. I was bound over for 12 months, and here I am." Vernon looked at the pub clock. "What I want to ask," I said. He didn't let me go on. "The hosepipe and the sticky tape. Well, it's obvious what I intended to do, isn't it?" "Of course, but, Vernon, what can have brought you to that point? I know things are quiet for everyone at the moment, but what can have pushed you to such a desperate act?" He took a puff and looked me in the eye. "Norman Bentinck." I didn't say anything I was thinking. Vernon looked surprised. "Do I have to say more?" Frankly, I was nonplussed. He obviously expected me to sympathize. He seemed to expect the same reaction from me as if he'd said Heinrich Himmler. "I don't know Bentinck personally," I said. "You know he directed my first picture years ago, don't you? That documentary about the kelp gatherers of Galway?" "No, no, that was a documentary. I mean my first feature, Brighton Girl. I remembered it. It was a modest success just before the war. Be on TV soon, I expect." Vernon exhaled smoke and shook his head. "The trouble that man caused me, rewriting and rewriting the rewrites. I thought I'd go crazy. I swore I'd never work for him again." "Dangerous to reduce the number of potential employers," I said. "Well, I dare say. I wish I'd stick to my guns, though. But I got involved a second time. It was my own synopsis. I suppose he'd picked it up in an agent's office. Took me to lunch to talk about it. I began to feel I'd been wrong about him. Then he suggested we move the locale from Wales to Yugoslavia, get finance from the tourist board, and switch the star parts. He said the Englishman's part was better than the Yanks. Thought he could get an American star to play it. Did, in fact. And, as I remember, Vernon, it worked quite well. Made money, didn't it?" "Jacko," he said, stubbing out his cigarette and obviously wishing the ashtray was my face, "if I specified a Rolls-Royce in the script, he would say, 'Why not a Ferrari?' If the hero called for a whiskey and soda, Norman Bentinck would say, 'Why not a gin and tonic?' It was piddling things like that, as well as the bigger changes. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that that man gave me absolute hell. Then, if you'll believe it, came the third time." "You were a glutton for punishment, Vernon." "I suppose I was, but that man is the Genghis Khan of the British film industry." I thought it prudent not to voice my opinion that a strong leader of that type was just what our industry needed. And Jacko, he stole my ideas. I'd never have any time for people who do that, Vernon. It's happened to me too many times. But he was in no mood to allow me to sound off about how I'd been plagiarized myself. He went on. I was silly enough to talk to him about my idea for a film about the Duke of Wellington. I saw it last year. Good historical hokum. I didn't know that was your script, Vernon. It wasn't my script. He was getting upset with me now, and I toned down my reactions from then on. After all, I didn't want him going to the station and throwing himself under a train. He pretended he wasn't interested, suggested Garibaldi as an alternative. After I'd been researching Wellington for years, Bentick suggests Garibaldi. Thought he could get Italian finance. Vernon shook his head, sadly. I thought to myself that this Bentick seemed to have a realistic idea about movies. Getting the money to make them is the most difficult part. Vernon went on. It was very quick thinking to switch the conversation round to Garibaldi. What does anyone know about Garibaldi? Except that he invented a sort of biscuit, and they don't even have those in America. No, he deliberately fobbed me off. And he waited 4 years before he came out with a big-budget picture using my ideas. It made a lot of money and was nominated for awards all over the place. When I read all about it, Jacko, I thought, what's the use? Well, I said, thank goodness you've recovered your sense of proportion. Did you ever get the car back, by the way? No, but it was only an old banger. I was upset about them taking the hosepipe more than the car. That was a good omen, Vernon. You were never meant to do away with yourself. The thief who took your car was an angel in disguise. We had another drink on the strength of that, and I walked him to the station, reminiscing about the old days at Alley Pally. Just before the train pulled out, I asked him how long he thought he'd be away. He shrugged. No idea, Jacko. I might even settle there and help my sister with the business. Anyway, I said, be sure to give me a bell when you're in town so that we can have another little session. Almost a year passed before I saw him again. I was walking along Great Portland Street when I spotted him coming towards me. He'd grown a beard and he looked a lot older. I called out teasingly, Vernon Coombs, your disguise is showing. He summoned up a smile so slight as to be almost invisible to the naked eye. Jacko, well. This is my first day in London since I saw you last. I've been clearing out my flat because I've settled down in Shropshire. I asked him if he had time for a cup of tea. We were just outside Guido's sandwich centre. In we went, and we were no sooner sitting down, and I'd told him what I was doing, which, unfortunately, didn't take long, before he launched into a diatribe about Norman Bentick. It was as though he was continuing where he'd left off a year before. Still bugging you, is it? I said. Can't you forgive and forget? Neither, he growled. Sometimes I wake up in the night sweating and muttering threats. I fantasize about ways in which I might get my revenge on the monster. I did my best to try and get him onto some other more upbeat subject. What do you do up there in Shropshire? I help my sister Elsie. I've always been fond of antiques, and I enjoy going to auctions looking for bargains. There's a camaraderie among the dealers. In a way, they're not unlike actors. More mature, of course. Do you do any writing? Oh, now and again I get an idea and I sit down and start to knock something out, but my creative urge just drains away when I remember how that man actually reduced me to planning to take my own life. Poor Vernon, he seemed to be a hopeless case, doomed to have this consuming rage eating at his guts forever. I tried to distract him by describing how I was persuaded to do a tour of primary schools with plays for kids and had been well-nigh lynched by a horde of bloodthirsty toddlers, just because my portrayal of a villain had been too realistic. I could see that Vernon was trying to enjoy the humour, but his mind was obviously on his stomach-churning grievance. But as he left for the station, he contained it long enough to invite me to drop in at the antique shop if I was ever in that area. He and Elsie would be pleased to see me, he said. Even so, I went home wondering if I'd ever see him again. Poor old Vernon, I thought. So, 6 years later, as the programmes of old-fashioned well-made plays used to say, I was attending the Ludlow Festival, a popular annual event that always includes a Shakespeare play performed in the grounds of the ancient castle. An agent friend, Now, an ex-friend had a young client appearing in The Merchant as Bassanio, and this lad was naturally very keen to be what is known as seen by potential employers. The agent failed to persuade any such person to go, but he wanted to keep his client happy, so he asked me to go in my role as a talent scout. My verdict on the performance was weary, flat, stale, and unprofitable. I reported it as such to the agent. Although he was not a Shakespearean scholar, he got the message nevertheless. Since I was so near to the village where the Coombs had the antique shop, I thought I'd drop in and see them. A chat and a noggin would make a pleasant diversion before I faced the drive back to London. It was a lovely English village with houses and shops built round the rectangle of fine turf. A cricket match was in progress, just to complete the picture. Just as I was about to ask one of the spectators the whereabouts of the antique shop, I spotted it, right opposite the church. Was I being rash, I asked myself. Was I walking right into another hour or so of ear-bashing from a bitter and obsessed scriptwriter? Having come so far, I decided to risk it. The bell clanged as I opened the door and went in. The little shop was packed with furniture and bric-a-brac. Lamps, witch-balls and chandeliers hung from the ceiling. Every surface was covered with brass, silver and glass. Lots of rubbishy china. There didn't appear to be much of any real quality, but there were items in the glass-fronted cupboards against the walls which looked interesting. The bell didn't seem to arouse anyone. I was enjoying the feeling one gets when you know you're going to give someone a surprise. I coughed and rang the bell again. I glanced towards the back of the shop and saw the face of an elderly lady reflected in the mirror of an overmantel which was propped on its side among the other furniture. It was Vernon's sister, of course, and she'd been watching me ever since I went in. She stepped forward. "Good afternoon," she said, smiling. "Can I help you at all?" "You must be Vernon's sister, Elsie." "Vernon? Were you a friend of my brother?" "Yes, J. Kingston Platt. I've been over in Ludlow." "I'm sorry, Mr. Platt. You obviously didn't know. Vernon died 2 years ago." She blew her nose. This was really a shock. 2 years ago? "I'm so sorry," I muttered rather feebly. The doctor wrote a lot of long words on the death certificate, but if you ask me, it was a simple case of a broken heart. "I see. He had an unhappy love affair? His career destroyed by that brute Norman Bentinck. Did he never tell you how appallingly he was treated?" "Oh, yes, I knew he'd had a bad experience, but I hoped he put it behind him when he settled down here." "Bad experience, you say? A lifetime's persecution, that's what it was. Then, just when he thought he'd get his revenge, everything went wrong." "I don't understand." "When they came here to film The Broken Line." "Did they really? I can see why they came here. It's a delightful little village, so unspoiled." "Yes, Vernon was here when the first cars rolled up, and Bentinck actually walked into the shop. Vernon was at the back and spotted him in the mirror, so he ran round and got me to come in and find out what he was looking for. Vernon wanted to avoid Bentinck recognizing him. Anyway, Bentinck and his set designer were here for half an hour or more. So arrogant. Picked up bits of china and glass and put them down again as if to say, 'Rubbish.' An insufferable man. But he did buy a Leedsware teapot. 200, I asked him. That was 20 more than I would have asked anyone else. 'That's a bit steep,' he said. 'Imagine with all that money.' I told him that was the price. 'Take it or leave it.' 'But I have several of these at home, which I bought for much less.' 'Lucky old you,' I said. He sneered and said, 'All right, here, Malcolm, you pay.' And his set designer gave me cash, and off they went. Well, Vernon was beside himself. Then he heard they were going to employ locals as extras for the crowd scenes. He enrolled straight away. He saw this as a God-given opportunity to get his own back." "How could he do that?" "Well, he couldn't make up his mind exactly how, but he was absolutely certain that this was his chance. He didn't eat anything that night and chain-smoked until he went to bed, and then he couldn't sleep. I heard him pacing about in his room. 3 times he came downstairs to make himself Ovaltine, and next morning he was sort of crazed. Nothing to do with the famous bedtime drink, of course. I can never resist a quip. Fortunately, she didn't notice. He got me to send the film company in London a receipt for the Leedsware teapot, with a note saying we weren't sure we gave him one when he was in the shop. The idea was that questions would be asked. Vernon was certain the teapot was for his own private collection. We posted the letter straight away. But, of course, that wasn't nearly enough to satisfy Vernon. He was trying to think of something really terrible to do to him. Would you care for a cup of tea? I accepted Elsie's invitation, and she took some brassware off a nice old Windsor chair, and I was able to sit down. Then she turned the card on the door from open to back in 10 minutes, and perched on a Victorian piano stool. Once we were settled with our tea and a biscuit each, she started to tell me all about Vernon's attempts to bring Bentinck to his knees. Still not knowing exactly how he was going to inflict a death blow on the hated Bentinck, Vernon turned up for work as an extra. He was told he would be an apothecary and given an outfit with a floppy hat and period spectacles. He saw this as a good omen because it meant there was even less chance of being recognized. You may not know the story of The Broken Line, but it doesn't matter. It was a sub-Thomas Hardy drama which didn't do well as a film. The people it might have appealed to were not people who go to the pictures. Apart from the usual hero, heroine, villain, and the friends of all three, there was the sinister vicar with a hare lip, a club foot, and a proclivity for drooling over the more risque passages of the Bible. This was the surefire award-winning part which ensured the actor playing it was out of work for several years afterwards. Shooting was based on the old rectory, right on the green, and trucks, vans, and cars were parked on the grass verge in front. The first scene involved a handful of villagers watching in silence as the heroine arrives in a horse-drawn carriage to marry a man they know she doesn't love. Vernon, now in his apothecary's costume, was called to join the crowd. On his way to the improvised wardrobe department in the servants' hall at the back, he noticed a huge Chinese vase on a plinth in the hall. As he passed it again on his way out, he nudged it ever so slightly nearer to the edge of the plinth. He'd been in antiques long enough to know this traditional dodge of the trade for stimulating the cash flow in difficult times. Any unlucky person who merely touches the table or whatever brings down the piece of china or glass and has to pay whatever the dealer can screw out of them. Vernon heard the crash minutes after he joined the crowd of wedding spectators. An innocent sound engineer had merely walked past it without even touching it, though possibly causing vibration. Anyway, it fell to the ground and smashed as he was halfway up the stairs to the loo. Wisely, he continued on his way. Later on, the owner of the house kicked up a huge fuss and had to be compensated. Vernon was well satisfied. 10 minutes after the start of hostilities, he'd scored a modest but inexpensive victory. It proved to be something of a false dawn. He spent the next day looking for ways of causing more trouble and expense. He heard the designer order green paint to spray over the village green because it wasn't green enough. Vernon got hold of some sodium chlorate, which he planned to pour into the paint, which would have killed all the grass. He knew this was bound to incense the locals and probably result in the unit being sent packing. Unfortunately, there was a shower of rain in the night, and the green turned to exactly the shade the designer wanted. Vernon wrote to the RSPCA and told them that Bentinck was ill-treating the horses, but by the time the inspector arrived, all the landau shots were finished and the horses had been dismissed. Then he noticed that extraneous sounds often caused problems for the recordist. Car sounds and airplanes were out of period, of course, but a dog barking some distance away made it impossible to edit the film. This gave Vernon an idea. After a chat with Mr. Beddoes, who had the big house next door to the old rectory, Vernon obtained his permission to shoot some of the rooks which had nests at the bottom of his big garden. Vernon's extra work finished, and he waited until the unit moved into the old rectory garden to film the wedding feast. Trestle tables with white tablecloths were laid out with lots of period food, and a trio of musicians from London stood by to play for the dancing. Once shooting started, Vernon blazed away with a borrowed double-barrel gun whenever he heard Bentinck shout the word action. It was here that Elsie Coombs's account became a trifle sketchy. Of course, up to now, she'd been describing to me everything that Vernon had told her. I was getting it second-hand, in other words. But now she seemed strangely uncertain about what actually happened. Apparently, there was a scuffle of some kind. Bentinck and his first assistant were involved, and Vernon was injured. Not very seriously, but enough to be taken to the cottage hospital, where he remained for over a week. When he was discharged, he refused to talk about his experiences with the film unit. Apparently, he reacted to it all like some soldiers do to a devastating battle. 2 years after that, he succumbed to pneumonia when attending a country auction in a very cold marquee in the middle of February. In spite of the best medical attention available, he passed away 3 days later. I made comforting noises and drove back to London thinking what a sad waste Vernon's life had been. He just never seemed to learn the art of compromise, which, in my opinion, is what movies are all about. They never work when the different departments all do their own thing regardless. There has to be give and take. My final chapter, as it were, depends on a remarkable coincidence. But a happy one, I'm pleased to say. It was several years later. I was lunching at a fashionable Soho club. I was the guest of a musical director friend whom I helped with my encyclopedic knowledge of popular music of the 30s. Afterwards, as we were leaving, an impressive white Mercedes drew up outside, and a slim, tanned, smartly dressed man of about 60 sprang out of it with a light step, muttered something to the driver, and turned into the club. He almost collided with my friend. "Harry," he shouted, "how are you, dear boy? Glad to see you. What are you up to?" Harry smiled nervously, obviously in awe of the great Norman Bentinck, for that's who it was. I'd last seen him at an award ceremony quite 20 years before, and he seemed untouched by time. As he stood chatting to Harry, I found it hard to believe that this apparently warm and genial man could have single-handed destroyed a lively talent like Vernon Coombs. As he talked, I noticed his eyes were darting around, and although I was deliberately hanging back, I saw him look at me twice. I realized he was wondering who I was. He was, no doubt, a man who believed in having a friendly word with everyone who came within his orbit, just in case they might come in useful sometime. Noel Coward always did the same thing. Harry saw his glances over to me and extended a grudging hand in my direction. "This is a friend of mine, J. Kingston Platt," he mumbled, "Mr. Norman Bentinck." And then he went on with what he'd been saying, but Bentinck wasn't listening. He was shaking my hand. "This is a great pleasure, Mr. Platt," he positively gushed. "I've admired your stories on the radio enormously. What a wonderfully varied career you've had, and how brilliantly you evoke it with sound alone. I keep your cassettes in my car and play some of those stories to visiting Americans. That one about the TVT commercial, oh," and he laughed aloud. You must forgive me for describing in detail this happy encounter, but truthfully, it was one of the most cheering I have ever enjoyed. Here was Norman Bentinck, an international director, standing in the street raving about my contributions to radio. He obviously knew some of the stories almost by heart, and actually quoted from the one about the Queen of TV soaps. Harry shifted his weight from one foot to another, as one does when being wiped out pecking order-wise. Norman went on oblivious. "Have you had lunch?" "Just finished." "So have I. What a nuisance. I'm meeting someone here for coffee. I'm a bit early. Do you have time to join me?" I turned inquiringly to my deflated friend. "We are not in any rush, are we, Harry?" "No, no, not at all." Bentinck grasped my arm and guided me towards the door. Then he stopped and stepped back to the car, which was still at the curb. "Hold on, there is one other thing." He opened the door and reached into the glove compartment. He took out the J. Kingston Platt cassette and handed it to me, together with his gold Mont Blanc pen. "Autograph this for me, will you? This is really a great thrill." I obliged with rather a shaky hand. Norman peered at it, beaming, before carefully replacing it in the car and leading the way into the club. In the bar, we relaxed with coffees and Remy Martins and cigars from Norman's monogrammed alligator case. He went on about my stories for quite some time, and of course I was on cloud nine and wished it could go on forever. One or two people came in and out, and Norman introduced them to me as if I were an eccentric megastar who had, for some reason, chosen to spend most of his life shunning publicity. Eventually, I felt confident enough to bring up the name of Vernon Coombs. "Oh, yes, dear Vernon," he said. "He was such a promising young writer. I really thought I'd made a marvellous discovery when he worked for me first. I tried to help him, but he was difficult to handle. He felt every word he'd written was sacrosanct, and every idea, too." The fact is, he didn't really understand what an idea was. He came to me once with the idea for a film about the Duke of Wellington, but I pointed out it would be much easier to get American money for a movie about Robert E. Lee or Grant, or, thinking of something nearer home, what about Garibaldi? Marvellous Life, more of a genuinely popular hero, and would attract a lot of European money, not just from Italy, but Austria, Switzerland, and others as well. I asked him if he'd like to do a bit of research on Garibaldi and do me a treatment. I offered him money. You know what he said? My idea was the Duke of Wellington. I explained it just didn't appeal to me, which was perfectly true at the time. A year or so later, an American company bought a best-selling biography of the Iron Duke and approached me about making a picture. By this time, I'd given up on old Vernon, and although I remembered his interest in the subject, I decided not to involve him. Too fraught, too many problems. "Do you see him at all?" he asked. I explained that he was dead, and Norman seemed genuinely sorry. Poor old Vernon. Then, in a moment, his expression changed to a broad smile, and then he laughed. "Did he ever tell you about the time we did some location work in the village he lived in?" "No," I said. I wanted to hear Norman's version and didn't want to spoil it by revealing that I knew already. "Oh, he had an antique shop in a village in Shropshire. Lived with his sister. We used the town square and the old rectory for scenes of the broken line. Not a huge success, but it's still doing well in the art houses in the States. Anyway, one day I breezed into the shop. No idea of Vernon being there or anything. I don't suppose I'd thought of him more than once or twice in 10 years. I talked to his sister. Didn't know she was his sister, of course. I bought a very nice Leedsware teapot. Used it in the picture. The old father hides the money from the sale of the horse in it. Nice piece. Paid 200. He laughed again. "Well, apparently, Vernon got the idea that I was cheating the company and wrote to them with a receipt saying I'd bought this teapot for my collection. Months later, some footling accountant wanted an explanation. I told him it was a genuine piece of the exact period. Used it in close-up. And then I suggested they send it to Sotheby's next sale of English pottery. It fetched 500. So they made a nice profit out of it, more than they made out of some of their pictures." I threw in a knowing little laugh. Then he said he was taken on as an extra, quite unknown to me. Well, as I told you, I didn't know he was within 1,000 miles of the place. But the curious thing was that minutes after he reported for work, there was an accident.